enormously intelligent and knowledgeable women who were given that opportunity and took it with both hands and ran with it and helped people along the way like me to continue the work.
Hello, I'm Ursy Downs and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries. The aim of Greater Than 11% is to increase diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women.
For episode 76, we are joined by Alison Stewart. Alison is a children's media consultant, executive producer, and writer. She's been nominated for a BAFTA for her work as director and scriptwriter and has produced content for the BBC, ITV, Channel 4 and Sky in the UK. Alison studied drama and French at the University of Hull. After graduating, she took a job at the BBC, working in the costume department as a holiday relief dresser, putting actors into their costumes. It was here that Alison first fell in love with TV production and pursued junior production roles at the BBC. She eventually specialised in children's television, working as a director, a producer, and most recently head of CBeebies Production, the BBC's channel for preschool children. In 2011, Alison helped to relocate her team from London to the BBC's new headquarters in Salford. Her team created and developed content for TV, online, mobile and radio for preschool audiences. Alison also managed several international co-productions in her role and was responsible for forming a relationship between the Northern Ballet and CBeebies, producing several ballets for the channel. She has also worked as a freelance writer and series producer, writing for some of the most beloved children's TV shows around, including The Tweenies, Play School and Postman Pat, which is the longest running animated series on television. Alison left the BBC to work on a number of development projects in 2018. Working with Lucy Murphy, head of kids content at Sky, she founded Hope Works, a global initiative comprising of a series of short films and additional learning resources, which promote tolerance and inclusion among children, their parents and carers. Alison, it is an absolute pleasure to welcome you to Greater Than 11%. I am so looking forward to talking with you today.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
You've done so much with your life and your career. I'm just so excited to get into the nitty-gritty of it and find out a bit more.
You know, I love these podcasts and I have done this sort of work for a long, long time. So I've got lots of things to talk about.
Brilliant. Yes, we're so lucky. We've had so many amazing guests. So you've held quite a few fascinating roles over the years. Could you tell me a little bit about your role as a children's media consultant?
Yes. Well, I left a full-time role in children's media a couple of years ago so I could explore other avenues for myself. So I don't define myself solely by that title. But basically, as a consultant for children's media, and that can be ideas for television or audio or online or mobile, people come to me for different reasons. So from my point of view, they might come for creative help with a proposal, like a TV series idea, and I can help them produce what we call the Bible, which is the kind of key document that you assemble that gives all the detail of the storylines, the characters, the environments, the USP, all of that. And sometimes I will help by writing a script to see how the idea develops as you begin to put it into a story form. So there's creative help. Then I can help with navigating the industry in the UK and internationally. And that means knowing who's working where, helping arrange meetings with people who might be commissioners or potential funding partners. Animation particularly is very, very expensive. And there's going to be no one company that's going to put up all the money for your production if it gets through. So you have to know where you can go to find that money. I like to put people together. So people come to me and go, well, we're doing this, but we need someone to help us with this specific aspect. So I can sometimes recommend. And as a consultant, also a nice part of it is you get asked to speak on panels and at conferences here and overseas. And I really, really enjoy that part of it as well. So basically a consultant, media consultant, is someone who uses their own experience to help other people make their way. And you have to give them honest and realistic advice. There are so many ideas out there that, you know, I always say to people at the beginning, the odds are not for you with your idea. Without wanting to be damning, you have to know how many ideas are out there, and then I can help give it its best chance, if you like. And there are always ways to advise and to help in that respect.
It sounds fascinating having to work on projects where there's lots of different elements of funding involved and lots of different creative minds working on that initial Bible. It must be a real rush.
It's a really good part of it. To be successful in any kind of media business, it's a real juggle between the creative wish and what you have to do to make that into a reality.
And I'm sure you must get used to working with different broadcasters or different commissioners, with that balance being different every time, and get to know what commissioners like more creativity and what commissioners want different aspects for their specific channels.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one thing I always say. You know, you need to watch the content that's out there, because every broadcast channel or on-demand platform has its own style and its own preferences. And there's no point taking idea A to broadcaster B if it's not going to match up. So that's a piece of insight that's really important.
So I'm fascinated to hear about how you got to be a children's media consultant. And I wondered if you could give me a bit of an overview for your career journey from where it began up till now.
So I did a drama and French degree at Hull University. And I have to say, I did a lot more of the drama degree than the French degree, because it was a wonderful course. And I left wanting to be an actor. But after a year of not doing very much, not getting very far, I took a 3-month holiday job at the BBC in the costume department as a dresser. A dresser is basically someone who puts actors into their costumes. You know, if it's period, you're doing up corsets. If you go out on a location, you take all the sets of clothes that the actors are going to need for all the different scenes. So that was what I was doing. And I thought, 3 months doing that over the summer, I'll be in London and then I'll go back to be an actor. But I started working in studios and went out on location, very quickly became very, very fascinated by the whole production process. And I was able to move into a junior production role, which was called a floor assistant in those days, basically a runner's job, and then moved on into more senior production roles. Did quite a lot of work in the light entertainment department to start with, which I enjoyed. But then I found I really enjoyed the work I did in children's. And so I started moving towards specialising in that area. I became a director and then a producer quite quickly. And then I had a baby. And when that baby was 6 months old, my husband died of cancer. So I was sort of thrown into this kind of turmoil of life events. Went back to work at the BBC and was very glad to, because actually at that time, that was the only thing about my life that was the same. Everything else had changed. So I welcomed the return to work. But by the time Robert went to school, I realised I needed a bit more of a flexible working life as a single parent. And I left the BBC and worked as a freelancer then, so that I'd have a bit more control over when I was working and when I could actually take a bit more time. And I worked freelance as a director and a producer, eventually a series producer, a script writer. Did a bit of work in the theatre, still mainly in the area of children's media. And then in 2007, I went back to the BBC for what I thought was a year's contract working in CBeebies, which is BBC's preschool channel. But for the second time, I got sucked back in and I actually stayed there for 11 more years. In 2010, I was promoted to become the head of CBeebies production. So I was looking after a team of people who worked in-house at the BBC, multi-platform teams. So there were TV people, radio people, and people who were working online and eventually into mobile applications. So it was a very mixed team. So that was a management job, but a creative management job, if you like. And then in 2011, the whole department moved up to the new Media City in Salford as part of a big move out of London that the BBC had arranged, which was a very challenging time, supporting the team through that move, saying goodbye to some really lovely people who chose not to make the move, and then recruiting new team members once we had moved, and keeping all our productions up and running at the same time during all the upheaval. So that was a biggie. I loved those years in Salford. It was like being pioneers in a way, and we were encouraged to go out and make new relationships and work in areas that we hadn't done before, and we did some great stuff. But I'd always planned eventually to move back to London. And then 2 years ago, there was a big restructure in the department and I took the opportunity then to make that move back. I've always considered London to be my home. That's where I've lived all my adult life. And I was pleased to be able to come back after what had been a great opportunity. And I wanted to have a break from managing people and take some time to do things that I wanted to do. And those things are always creative things. So 2 years ago, I came back and now I do those things that you've outlined. I do some consulting, I do some writing, I do all kinds of other things, and just enjoying opening my life out a bit.
Wow, what a fantastic career, not just in terms of the roles that you've had, but the breadth that you've done and the different kind of places you've worked in. Working in Salford sounds so exciting. I bet treading that new ground was just really electric to be there at that time.
The building was new. We were like the first people in. When you take a big step like that, it's scary, but always has really, really positive results. And I think that move was really, really good for what we were doing in our department and for the others who made that move.
Fantastic. I'm wondering if I can take you back a little bit and ask you about why it was that you fell in love with children's broadcasting in particular, all the way back when you were doing light entertainment.
Well, actually, I had the opportunity to move on in that area as well. And I took the route through children's because I really wanted to be a director and there were opportunities there. But there were other reasons as well. The children's department at the BBC gave you massive creative opportunities. And my first role as a director when I was in my 20s was on a daily show for preschoolers called Play School. And the idea was you'd be given a theme for a week of programmes. They might be rather obscure themes. I remember I had to make a week of programmes with the title Wool. You come up with all the ideas for stories, songs, films, activities, makes, all those kinds of things. And then you write 5 20-minute episodes and you work with musicians, designers, technical teams to prepare the scripts and get them ready for the studio. And then you'd finally go in and studio direct them as live. You could only stop recording if an absolute disaster happened because the editing facilities were quite limited. So they wanted you just to keep going. And that early experience in really crafting a show from beginning right the way through to the end gave me a fantastic start. Secondly, I realized that children's was an area of TV production, which was pretty unique at the time in that women were taking very senior roles. At that time, television production was a very male-dominated industry. But when I started working in children's TV, there were some very bright and very powerful female role models leading the way there. And I loved working with that young audience, and I always have. Because when you make content for very young children, you can give full range to your imagination because that's what they do. They're so wide-eyed and you can go anywhere with them. So I love that. And it was a fun time. We had fun making these programs.
Gosh, it just sounds like the best job in the world, honestly. I would love to spend a week thinking about ideas for shows about wool. That's amazing.
You kind of go, how am I going to make 5 programs about wool? You can play with wool, you can tell stories about sheep, you can make content out of anything for young children, because everything for children of that age, it's fun, but it's also a learning experience. So there's just so much you can do with them.
That is brilliant. Speaking of the learning aspect, how important was the inclusion of potentially educational content into those shows that you were creating?
Well, they weren't educational shows per se. These children's programmes are basically entertainment programmes, but every piece of content for very young children has a learning element. The theory has always been, right back from those play school days, learning through play. And the content is very slowly introducing those children to the world, starting with familiar environments like home and family, and then widening as they grow older. And good children's content helps them begin to understand emotions and how they socialize. As I say, that's why I've always loved working for young children. You have that opportunity to build foundations for them as they then get a little bit older and go off to school and start getting all other kinds of influences. Within that age range, there's no limit to what you can do, really.
Yeah, it really is fantastic to have such an inquisitive audience, to have them hooked on your every word and also take them off into those dreamlands. That's just
absolutely. Yeah, and the imaginations, as I say, there's no limit.
You touched on it a little bit about the departments for children's at the BBC being quite different in structure to everything else that was going on at that time in production. Why do you think that was? Why do you think there were more opportunities for women in children's media production?
I think at the time, and this is way back, you know, in the early 60s, the people who were in charge at the BBC were men. And I think they thought, well, if we're making stuff for children, then women had better do it, because women look after children, because at the time they largely did. But the women who took the jobs were very bright and took that opportunity, and they went off and made relationships with educational consultants and all kinds of people who are going to build the foundations for the work. And because they were there at the very beginning, they always welcomed women and gave them opportunities. And, you know, I have to say, there were people, even when I began, who were still slightly looking at children's as, oh, it's a woman's job. That's what the women do in television. But it's grown and it's grown and it's grown. And, you know, in latter years, children's content has become commercially very attractive. So there's all kinds of business elements around it that now it's not perceived as a female environment anymore.
That's lovely to hear that women were sort of giving each other a leg up in that environment. That's great.
And they were. Those ladies, you know, some of them are still going now, you know, enormously intelligent and knowledgeable women who were given that opportunity and took it with both hands and ran with it and helped people along the way like me to continue the work.
Brilliant. That's just great to hear. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the different skills you need. You touched on it a little bit in your introduction, to be a writer, say, versus an executive producer.
Well, writing, it can be lonely. You have to be prepared to spend an awful lot of time on your own. If you're going to be writing on a writing team, because a lot of shows don't have a single writer, so you need to be collaborative. There'll be a lot of people with opinions and you need to listen very hard to all those different things. You need to be patient as a writer. There are many, many stages to writing a script for television, and sometimes the brief can change as you go along. You're working usually to a Bible, as I explained at the beginning. You'll have a production Bible that gives you all the detail of a show if it's an existing show. So you have to, you can't write characters in a different way if they don't behave that way. So you have to do all of that. And then you wait for feedback on your scripts, and you'll always have to do second drafts, third drafts sometimes. And those requests for rewrites and the feedback never come when you're expecting them. And you then have to turn them around to someone else's timescale. So patience is a good virtue as a writer. Obviously, anyone will tell you, if you want to be a writer in any way, you have to read and read and write and write and write just to get those muscles working. Then an executive producer is, you know, they're working on a program or an idea or a piece of content from the very, very early stages, right the way through to delivery, to brief on time, on budget, and knowing enough about the business to be able to make changes along the way to achieve those things, because things on production hardly ever go as planned. And there's always something that's going to cost more than was budgeted for, or it's a film series and the weather's absolute rubbish for weeks and your schedule goes to pot. And that means you have to have the knowledge of all the roles of the people that you're working with so that you can get the best from them without asking unreasonable things of them. You have to know how people work together. You have to know how to guide a show as it develops and when to be hands-on and when to be hands-off and let people do their jobs. You have to be supportive and know your team, but always ask for more if you need more. So the executive producer has their arms around the whole production. And the writer, you know, is one of those people who is on in at the early stages. And it's not so much of a sociable job. I mean, writers make their own communities because they do spend such a lot of time kind of on their own, staring out of the window, as I found myself when I've done that. So those are the main differences, I suppose.
That's so interesting that those roles are in such contrast to each other, the sort of writer and the solace of that role, and then an executive producer sort of managing so many different people's feelings.
Very much. feelings and abilities, an executive producer has to walk that narrow bridge between wanting the creative to achieve and making the business part of it work. You have to know enough about the creative side and the production management side so that you know that what you're asking for can be achieved. Resilience is a word that comes in time after time, that you can't get down on yourself if something isn't working quite as planned. You just have to go, right, that's not happening. How are we going to do this? And if you're not resilient, you're not going to last very long in that industry, I think.
You're so right. That's actually one of the very steep learning curves I had quite early on as a producer, was just to pick myself up and just carry on. As head of CBBC production, you helped to relocate a team from London to the new BBC headquarters in Salford. That role required a different sort of creative skill to your role as a writer or series producer. Could you talk to me a little bit more about that?
So when I became the head of production, and I was working with producers and executive producers and people all the way down the line, you have to be very careful that you're not wanting to create them in your own image, if you like, that everybody has a different style and different ideas. And although you want to guide them, you can't make them do it as you would do it. I used to say that really, if you're going to be a manager of a team, those people are always your greatest resource, and you have to spend time with them and getting to know them and their styles and how different people work with different people. So that becomes a creative job in a way, a different creative job, but still is how to get the best out of a team and appreciate the differences of all those people. And then, you know, going back to the relocation, that's a time of stress for people. It's immensely stressful. People were moving families, they were moving away from families, leaving friends behind. And so, you know, the personal style of management, I think, suited that time well, because you needed to give them the time and the support.
Did you come away from your role there and reflect on what you preferred, or do you do that now, or do you have a preference between the writing and the smaller teams, or having that community underneath you?
So I loved the management job. But I think the job that I really enjoyed the most in television was the directing job, where you were actually being creative and working with the creative people and not having the massive overview responsibilities that the more senior roles had. And I love to write as well. And that's a different thing again. And I still love to act. And I knew that when I stopped doing the BBC job and having made my time my own, if you like, you need a little bit of time to stop and think, what is it you really want to do? And I thought, I want to, not to be a professional actor, but I want to go back and study. So I've been doing acting classes and courses and realised that that love that was there at the very, you know, the beginning of my life is still there.
Things have come almost full circle for you, and you've sort of gone back to your degree almost in what you wanted to do.
I do, you know, and I do, it's a process that is fascinating, and I haven't studied it. A drama degree is not the same as a kind of vocational drama course. There are so many more things you can learn to do it better. But I love the theatre anyway. I find it absolutely fascinating. And I'm lucky now that I'm able to do other things. I'm not working full time. I'm doing a number of different things as they come along, which I love.
That must be lovely. And sort of getting to interact with scripts and the written word in a really different way, that must be quite thrilling sometimes.
Very, very much, in terms of the different approaches, the different types of work. You know, having done writing in certain capacities and then acting other people's words, it all feeds into itself in a creative way.
Fascinating. I'm wondering, for somebody who might not have any experience in working in TV production, could you maybe describe the structure of the team at CBeebies, just to give us a real picture?
Yeah, well, it's a complex map. So CBeebies is a channel, had a channel controller who was the person who would select the content that they wanted to go on the channel. And they would take ideas from independent production companies, and they would take things from our in-house team, the one that I was leading. And so within that team, There were people who were working on ideas for television. There was a CBeebies radio team. And then in production, there are the people who actually go out and make the programs. So they'll be the team who are the director and the assistant directors, and the producer will be there. And the other side of it is production management. And production managers look after budget, they look after the finance, they look after all the rights, they do all the scheduling of a production, they manage the movement of everybody. Entry-level jobs are runners. Runners come into, they'll either be an office runner or they might be working on a production team, and those are the entry-level jobs for people who actually want to work in TV production on that side. And then there are production management assistants and team assistants who come in very early and start very wide support and gradually move through into roles of production coordinators, production managers, production execs, and they move up that way. And you get to the top of those ladders and you could become a producer from either side, from the more the technical side of making the shows, or from the production management side of doing everything that you need to do to make them happen.
I wanted to ask you about one of the more recent projects that you've been working on as well, Hope Works. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about that.
Yes. So the idea came in 2016, and I was at the Children's Media Conference, which happens every year in July in Sheffield, and I was at a dinner, and it was just days after the referendum vote, where the UK had voted to leave the EU. And within those few days, there was already evidence of people abusing people, of sort of hate crime going on, leavers and remainers being angry with each other. It was also the time of just running up to the American elections, and also the refugee crisis was in full flow. And I don't know if you remember, there were pictures on the front of all the national papers and online of a baby's body washed up on the beach, and it was a grim time. And I sat next to Lucy Murphy, who is head of kids content at Sky, and we were saying, this is a grim time for grown-ups, and what must kids be thinking who get this unfiltered news? Quite often the older ones who have phones, and it's not always accurately reported, and it's a very unsettling time. And that conversation evolved almost immediately into, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could get our international colleagues to help us produce some content which would provide reassurance to those children and to promote values of tolerance and inclusion and kindness at a time when they weren't seeing many examples of it. And we walked around the room. It was a big dinner, and talked to people who were in quite powerful positions in different countries and different roles. And they all said, oh yes, we'd do something. So that was the beginning of it. And it evolved into an idea where any broadcaster or producer who could afford to fund a film, short film, for Hope Works, they would then get back the set of films that had been made by the other producers and broadcasters. And we ended up with 12 partners. Disney and DreamWorks made a film, Sesame Workshop made a film, ABC in Australia made a film, CBC in Canada made a film, Hop TV in Israel made a film, and we guided them with five major themes. We wanted to not just reassure kids, but to empower them. And we put them on a website, which is still there, and the films are all still there. And it's www.hopeworksproject.com. So you could have a look. And we launched it 2 years later. It took a long time to get there, on UNICEF International Children's Day in November. And we're so proud of it. Now, that was done with very, very little money. We didn't make the films, but we guided the whole initiative. But the brilliant thing was, the whole idea was, it didn't belong to any one person. It belonged to that group of children's program makers and broadcasters who recognized the need at the time for that support for children and gave so generously. I suppose in the long run, it would be great to make more films. I think HopeWorks would then have to be set up as an entity in its own right in order to fundraise for it and do it. And that might or might not happen. But that's basically that project. I'm very proud of it.
What a beautiful concept. And I've watched some of the HopeWorks videos and they are beautiful. Really lovely.
They really are.
They're so nice. I particularly enjoyed the treacle.
That's the DreamWorks one.
It's lovely, that one. It's really nice.
Yeah, no, they were some brilliant films, brilliant selection of live action and animated. And as I say, those partners were very generous.
Yeah, that's such a fantastic coming together, not only of broadcasters from around the world, but of different sorts of creative ideas, all to tackle these massive problems that, you're right, children are very much faced with, even if they're not consuming that content directly. It's kind of all around at the moment, especially things like COVID. You can't get away from it.
No, and also we've realised that after we set the whole thing up, during that period where we were developing the project, the reports were coming back of growing anxiety amongst very young children. If you're going to make content for those children and young people, you have to be very, very aware of, you know, what they're dealing with, which is very different from generations before them, and accommodate that in the way that you make your content.
Well, I think you've done that very well in the HopeWorks project. It's brilliant, and I can't wait to see it evolve. I hope it does. I'm wondering if I can ask you what you love about being a children's media consultant.
Well, I love the variety of the jobs that come along. I really like partnering people with other people in order to progress the ideas. I love being able to make a creative contribution when asked, when they need that. Always enjoy that, to help develop an idea, as I say, and sometimes to write those ideas out into early script form. I really enjoy doing that. And then when people come to me for advice or for consultancy, it makes me realize how much I actually know. You work for a lot of years, you build up a lot of experience, and you don't hold it in your head all the time. But it's only when people come and ask you for advice or ask you questions that you realise quite how much there is to say.
Yeah, there's lots to say. And I'm glad you've shared lots of it with us today. I'm sure that there's lots of other people who are going to be grateful as well for all your experience and your stories. I mean, you've just had an amazing career.
It's been a very blessed one, I have to say. I've loved every year of it.
I wonder if you could talk to me about a challenge that you faced in your career.
So, big challenge was the relocation when I was at the Beeb. Other big challenges are being given a job as a series producer and having to set a whole enormous production up. But I think the biggest personal challenge probably was unexpectedly becoming a single parent, which, you know, it wasn't a planned thing at all. And having to sort of balance the needs of a child when you are a single parent with keeping a career going, which I loved and really wanted to progress in. And having to make those kind of balances and choices at a time of grief, when you're kind of going, what the hell just happened? You know, one minute there was a husband and now there's a child and not a husband, and what's going on? And I found that at the time, because the baby, Robert, was so young, there was nothing but to look after him. And he was a fantastically accommodating baby. I loved bringing him up. But I think it was about 2 years after the event that I'd gone back to work, and everyone was going, you've done so well, have you managed to do this? About 2 years after, and people often say it's a 2 year point. I think the trauma hit at that point, and I needed to go and get some counselling, some external help, just to sort of unravel it. After that, you carry on. And I think at the time, as I say, at the time of the event, it didn't seem like a big challenge. It was only later I looked back and thought that was pretty epic.
Yeah, that sounds immensely difficult to have to deal with. And just an absolute credit to you that you were able to go back to work and find strength in being there and continuing with your career like that.
Well, I think the love that I've expressed really for the sort of work that I've done, I didn't want to give it up, and I wanted to progress and do well. So I mean, at that time, because this was 30 years ago, there still weren't that many women coming back to work with young babies. A lot of the people hadn't got to the stage where they could have both. There were a few, but not very many. And I was aware at the time, gosh, you know, you look around these rooms and there are very few people with children managing their lives and doing all of this. And I do remember very clearly, as the baby grew up, he was very lively and he didn't sleep a lot. And I used to go to work, come home, bring him home from the nursery, and he'd be bouncing on his bed at about 11 o'clock at night. And I remember sitting at 3 in the morning writing a camera script, which is when you've done your rehearsals for a show, you write a script. So you've decided what camera's going to take what shot and you have to write it all up. It was 3 in the morning and I suddenly thought, this is what my life's going to be like, to do all these things. And you just kind of go, well, I'm a person who doesn't need a lot of sleep either, so I'll just do that. And that was a moment, I think, where you just kind of go, you can do it. It's not going to be easy always, but there are ways. And I think now there's so much more understanding of the balance that you have to have. And that's not just for women, that's for men as well who have families. And I wasn't the only one. I'm not making myself out to be some kind of a martyr, but I do remember there weren't many around.
Really must have been quite lonely at times to feel like there wasn't that many people who were able to empathise with the balance of that life and the difficulties of being up at 3 in the morning and still working with a baby.
I loved the work I was doing at the time, I remember. And it was almost like that was my social life, with people I liked and people that you could have a laugh with. Nobody gave me a hard time, nothing but support. But in the workplace, I was very aware that there weren't many people at the time like me, not many women, shall we say. But it wasn't an unhappy time. You know, we had such a good time doing some of the stuff that we were doing then that that kind of helped carry me through, I think.
That's so nice to hear. And I definitely feel the full force of that production family environment as well. It is wonderful to be able to socialise and have friends at work in that way. And I think working on something creative that is very close to your heart often brings people together like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm so glad that you were able to overcome that challenge. And thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing that with us today.
You can't separate your professional life from your own one, and if you try to, I think you don't do so well, you know. And I just think, you know, a life is a life, and what you've done professionally feeds into how you grow as a person and vice versa. It has been an immensely enjoyable life and still is. You know, the people that I've worked with and work with are great people to work with, so I'm very, very lucky.
I'm wondering if you could give somebody who's aspiring to work in children's media any advice on either being a director, a producer, or a writer, and whether you've got any tips for anybody who kind of wants to go down that road.
If you want to be a writer, if you really want to be a writer, then I think you always wanted to be a writer, and you'll hear authors and anybody who writes anything just saying, if that's what you want to do, then that's what you do. You write and you write and you write and you read other people and you write some more. And with telly, you know, you watch and you listen to the voices and you begin to sort of evolve your own style. So you have to make those muscles work. For children's TV, as with any media, know your audience. Watch a lot of telly, learn the style of the shows, see what's out there before you spend a lot of time creating something that you then find is already out there. There are courses for writing for many different types of media. Obviously, you can study it, you know, long term as a degree. BBC Writers' Room offer great opportunities. A lot of theatres offer initiatives for new writers. You can try and find your way to somebody who works in production and see if you might be able to come in and spend a bit of shadowing time for production. If you want to be a director or a producer or whatever, there are ways through into work experience, which is sometimes what people have to do to begin. A lot of independent companies, a lot of public service broadcasters offer work experience schemes. And so you need to do a bit of homework about what, you know, what companies offer. Again, homework. What indies do what type of programs, who do the documentaries, who do the factuals, who do the entertainments, and tailor what you do. Most companies have talent managers whose job it is to encourage new people into the business. So find out who the talent managers are for the different companies. Contracts are often short. Sometimes you'll only get a deal for a couple or 3 months at a time. So you have to make the most of every opportunity. If you get a three-month contract and it's your first one in, be prepared to do whatever people ask you to do. They might be quite basic, but you need to do your job happily and always offer to do more. Always find out if there's anything else you can do that will help. Watch and learn. Talk to people when they have time. Don't get in the way when they don't have time. And just grab any opportunity to extend your experience. And again, for children's, you have to know that audience and you have to like being around kids because you're going to be. I mentioned the Children's Media Conference earlier, and that is the biggest conference for kids media in the UK. It happens every year in July. This year, obviously, it's not going to happen, but I'm on the advisory committee and we are having a virtual CMC. Children's Media Conference is now the Children's Media Community. And we're arranging over from the 10th to the 16th of July, a series of workshops, live streamed events and recorded webinars that really cover all aspects of our industry, whether it's production or research or education or marketing, you know, all those things. So you can join the virtual CMC. Going to the conference for a new person in the industry is invaluable. And I would always say, pluck up your courage and go, because the conference is very friendly to newcomers. It wants to make them feel included. And you will meet people from all areas of the business there. So I couldn't recommend that enough.
That was a wonderful advice. Thank you so much. And I might even look up CMC myself.
It is a great Oh, for everybody. It's very much loved by the people who go there because it is friendly and people will talk to you.
Oh, that's lovely. And I know we touched on it a little bit in terms of talking about you going back to acting and that being a real fuel for your creativity. But I'm wondering what else you do. What do you do? Where do you go?
Oh, God. Well, I fuel my creativity by talking to creative people. I get enthusiastic whenever I talk to someone new about their work or their projects, and whole new avenues begin to unfold that you can use and do. There's always something new to learn. And at the moment, another thing that I'm doing is I'm a trustee for a local community library. And because the libraries are closed at the moment because of coronavirus, I've been running virtual events and clubs and workshops for the local residents. And so that by talking to these people who are offering different things, you just get a taste of their own worlds, and that has to help your own creative juices. I read, I love the theatre, I love the cinema, I love art galleries, I watch TV, I listen to the radio, all those different media. The acting is in my veins, although, as I say, I'm not trying to be a professional, but I know it's something that goes right into me. And I've come back around to it, so that fuels me. And I always feel better having been to the classes. And even if you don't feel you've done brilliant work, you just feel that you have been creative, which is great. And when I'm working on an idea for myself, if I'm writing a script or whatever, I've always found that to let an idea settle, I need to get away from all the tech and go out and walk. I walk lots. And while you do that, as I say, things kind of form and you can come back and start again with the blocks built a little bit higher maybe. And I love the natural world. I draw a lot of energy from that and changing seasons. And most of all, I love the sea. And being by the sea, I find very restoring. So going out and not thinking you're doing the work is where a lot of that thinking kind of resolves itself, I always find.
I couldn't agree more with regard to the natural world, walking and the sea. I also find those things incredibly inspiring and just sort of rejuvenating with your creative juices as well. I always find there's something wonderful about coming back from a walk and suddenly being re-energized or having, as you say, let things settle in your mind.
Yes, and sitting over a laptop all day is not creative.
No.
Whatever you're trying to do with it, So that, I think you'll hear lots of people saying that, that you have to step away after a period and just zone out a little bit, just to let things fall into place.
Yeah, very definitely. I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about what you've got coming up in the next few weeks or months. I know that things are sort of all turned on their head at the moment and nobody knows when we're going to come out of lockdown. But it's wonderful that you're doing workshops for your local library.
Yeah.
And that the CMC is going online too. That's great.
Yes. So those things, I mean, who knows what the next few weeks or months will bring. I've got four smaller development projects. When I say smaller, that means in terms of the amount of time I'm actually needed on them now, not the size of the project themselves. Two of those are animated series proposals for a children's series. One's a live action show that is related to learning English as a second language. So it's like a comedy show, quite slapstick, quite sparse in terms of words because they're learning words, but very funny. So that's a nice one to do. And then a really new area of work, which I can say what it is, but not a lot. I'm about to do some work on a libretto for a family opera, which is an area of work that I've never encountered before, which is thrilling because it's new. That's something I'll be doing over the next little while. And then when we can get out of lockdown, I want to go to Costa Rica and have wanted to go for the last 2 years, but have never quite found the space in which to go. So I think God knows when, but when those, you know, when those planes are flying again and everything's opening up, I will make myself do that.
Wow, I'm so looking forward to looking out for whatever comes out of the libretto work for the opera.
That didn't come out of the blue from somebody. And first of all, I thought, well, I've not done that before. And then I thought, hell, you know, I can do this. Because actually, you know, you'll take a story and you'll work out how you can make it work in a dramatic form. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, I have no doubt that will be amazing.
Yeah, so lots of things to be getting on with, as well as tidying out your drawers and cleaning up your house and doing all those things we're supposed to be doing at this precise moment.
Definitely, yeah, I'm doing quite a lot of that myself. Now we're coming to the end of our interview, and it's just been so lovely talking to you. I could honestly talk to you for hours, and I've just got two more questions to ask you, which I ask everybody who comes on the podcast. Is there a career or job in the creative industries that you know little about but have always been curious about?
There's very few that I know little about, because having worked in it, you know, you do see people come through, but there are roles that I've always admired because I think I wouldn't know where to start. And one of those is a composer of music in terms of TV, whether they've done a score for a series or a film, or whether they've written a theme tune or a song, or they've done incidental music. I just so admire the work that they do. And I think some producers find working with composers quite daunting if they're not musically, you know, trained or adept. They're frightened to talk to them because they think they don't know how to talk. But again, you have to find ways to have those conversations so that you can talk about what you want. It doesn't have to be in detailed musical terms for someone to understand your brief. When you're making a program and editing a program, the music is quite often the last thing that goes on. And when you've made a dramatic show or a comedy show or whatever it is, and you know, a narrative rather than documentary, by the time the music goes on, you finally see it as you had it in your head, because the timing's right and the pacing of the show is right, if you've left, and the emotions are all enhanced, and there's a sort of magic to it. So anybody who can do that has my deepest admiration.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. It is the final magic touch, isn't it?
It really is. It pulls the whole, threads the whole thing together. It makes it what it should have been all along.
Mm. Oh, I'd love to interview somebody that does that job for the podcast. That'd be great. My next question is there a woman within the creative industries that you'd love to hear on Greater Than 11%?
Yes, there is. There is. And I was talking to her last night and told her I was going to do this. And her name is Jo Collins. And Jo Collins is MBE, co-founder of an inclusive theatre company in London called Chicken Shed. And she set this company up back in the 70s with a lady called Mary Ward. And they started off as like a children's theatre workshop and then began to invite children from local care homes and children with different abilities to come and join. And it evolved into an ethos where anybody who wanted to come to the company to join could. And the idea was that if you bring people in with what is perceived as a disability, it's not about, oh, well, let's help them because they're needy. They will bring something creative to an overall process. And they've evolved this in a beautiful way. And Jo was the head of music and the co-founder and went about her business to take the work out, you know, into the wide creative world and has done amazing things. And Chicken Shed is still thriving now. And if you had her, she'd be brilliant.
She sounds absolutely incredible. I would love to interview her.
I think she would fit in beautifully into the set of podcasts that you've got.
Thank you so much for coming on to Greater Than 11%. It's just been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And I've loved hearing about your life and your career. And I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I hope with all that we've discussed, there's enough ideas there for people who are just beginning to start out, as well as me talking about my life. I've really enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review and rate, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%.